welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering shows from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark LeVanier. Coming up in this hour, variety from the Radio Hall of Fame from May 7th, 1944. We'll hear a mix of drama from William Gargan and Mary Astor, and music from singer Connie Boswell and the Benny Goodman Quartet. Just months before, the Metropolitan Opera House in New York hosted a jazz concert for the very first time, and Benny Goodman was one of the performers. The man who drummer Gene Krupa called the King of Swing was in his heyday at the time of this broadcast, next of the Radio Hall of Fame.
This is the Radio Hall of Fame. Radio Hall of Fame is presented during the full hour ahead by Philco Corporation, makers today of radar and electronic battle equipment for the fighting forces of the United Nations, makers tomorrow of equipment for good living in a free world united by victory. Each week, the editors and correspondents of Variety report and select for the Philco program the hits of the show world from all fields of entertainment. And now, may I present our master of ceremonies, the distinguished composer, author, and commentator, Dean Staler.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This week, the editors of Variety recommend for your pleasure, and Philco delights to honor in your name,
from radio and motion pictures, Connie Boswell. From radio and the recording studios, Benny Goodman. From motion pictures, Mary Astor and William Gargan. From vaudeville and radio, Dr. Rockwell.
And entering from stage left to conduct the Philco Radio Hall of Fame Orchestra and Chorus comes Paul Whiteman.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Whiteman speaking. Today's overture is based on a spot of music by Jerome Kern. Later on today, we'll have more to say about Jerry. Meanwhile, one of his latest called Make Way for Tomorrow.
And it comes from the score of the current picture success, Cover Girl.
Thank you.
Connie Boswell. And of all her recordings, the all-time favorite is her swing version of the aria Mappari, known simply as the Martha Selection. And Connie Boswell is going to sing it for us today exactly as she recorded it. Two easy ways to introduce Benny Goodman. One is to talk steadily for 10 minutes, and the other is to say simply, "Here's Benny Goodman." I'm tempted to take the second way because it's very difficult to compress his career into a comparatively few words. Back in 1934, Variety hailed a new style of playing that his band introduced called swing, and that band has been swinging for millions ever since. As a clarinetist, Benny is equally famous as a swing virtuoso and a serious concert artist. He has invaded the sacred precincts of chamber music and has been soloist with 9 of our major symphony orchestras. His latest picture, soon to be released by 20th Century Fox, is Sweet and Lowdown. Today, a welcome visitor to the Radio Hall of Fame, he brings us his famous swing quartet, comprising Sid Weiss at the string bass, Cozy Cole on the drums, Teddy Wilson at the piano, and with his clarinet, the king of swing himself, Benny Goodman. Thank you. That is, I imagine most of you know, was Body and Soul. That was wonderful, Benny. Do you suppose now, by way of contrast, we might have a little something a little more...
You mean the lighter side of Goodman, Dean?
That's it.
What about After You've Gone?
Solid. Radio Hall of Fame welcomes two famous screen stars, a pair who arrived at their present exalted station by two very different roads. One is William Gargan, Brooklyn-born, who, after a checkered career as salesman, collector, payroll guardian, and soda jerker, found his great opportunity as the butler in Philip Barry's play, The Animal Kingdom. The movie scouts knew a good actor when they saw one, with the result that you've been seeing him on the screen ever since. The other is Mary Astor. Playing her first motion picture assignment at the age of 14, she soon became a star of the silent pictures. Then came sound, to the ruination of many a career, but not Miss Astor's, for it turned out that Mary Astor sounded as well as she looked, which is no faint praise. And so she became a star all over again. And now it's with great pride that Philco presents Mary Astor and William Gargan in Milton Geiger's Moral Victory, with music by Paul Creston.
The scene, a big city nightclub. At a secluded table sit a man and a woman. The woman, though attentive to her escort, is nevertheless highly alive to her surroundings. The man is large and square-looking. There is something solid and substantial about him. He is not quite comfortable in these exotic surroundings. The girl is born to it. The man watches the girl indulgently as she looks about, talking a steady commentary on the things around her that seemed to hold an endless excitement for her.
Look, Dan, isn't that Kramer Cleveland coming in, the actor?
Wouldn't know.
What a stunning blonde he has with him.
She don't stun me.
Doesn't, darling.
Same thing.
It is Kramer. His new play isn't doing any too well, poor darling.
It worries me sick.
Oh, shush, Dan. Those things mean something to some people.
Not me.
Well, they should.
Not me. I'm ignorant.
You're not. You just try to be.
How am I doing?
Splendidly.
That takes care of me, I guess.
Daniel.
Oh, call me Dan.
Doesn't it occur to you that in your own way you're a kind of a snob?
Who, me?
You are a snob, Daniel. The worst kind of a snob.
Here we go.
I mean it. And your kind of snobbery is just as annoying and real as
your kind?
Well, yes.
Aren't we the honestest people we ever talk to?
My snobbishness is the uptown variety, but I know it, and I'm on my guard against it. Yours is the snobbishness of the self-made man, the plugger who came up the hard way to become district attorney, no less.
Isn't that good?
Oh, it's fine, Dan, really, and I'm very proud of you. But sometimes you can be most annoying.
Wait until we're married 3 years. All those little differences will be ironed right out. Marriage, like war, is a mighty leveler. I read it in a book. That thick.
I wonder...
What?
About us. Which of us is the stronger?
Want to wrestle?
If it came to a contest of wills, of principles, who would win? The district attorney who got where he is by sheer force of will and ambition?
What about character?
Or the uptown girl, very possibly with some character of her own. Who'd win? Who would be the stronger?
Well, let's make an issue and see. Name your weapons.
Oh, Dan, I'm serious. It's really something we ought to know about before we're married, don't you think? It rather comes under the heading of, are we good for each other? Or don't you think so? Or do you think...
What's the matter?
Haskell Beecher just came in.
Oh.
You'd better take me home, Dan. Now.
Now, there's the case in point, Lola. I have every reason to dislike Haskell Beecher as much as you do.
Dislike him? I hate him.
Granted. He's hurt you and he's hurt me.
My father would be alive today if Haskell Beecher hadn't broken him with his crooked stock deal.
I know, and I feel about him as you do. But I don't go showing my colors in public. If he came over to my table, I'd probably buy him a drink. Bide my time.
I'll leave if he even looks this way.
Just so. I've learned to behave like a civilized human being. You haven't. Of the two of us, I have better discipline.
Discipline? Hypocrisy.
No, darling. This is a kind of a test, isn't it? The kind you meant.
I don't want to talk about it anymore. Take me home, Dan. Take me home before I...
Violence, Lola? It isn't done. Now, if I were you, Lola...
Please, Dan, I want to go home.
Okay.
Why did you send for me, Dan? We don't usually meet for dinner in your office.
I thought we could have a chat together. We haven't seen each other in a week, you know.
But why did you have me come to your office?
Lola, there's no immediate cause for alarm.
Alarm?
Well, I might as well come to the point. If I seem brutally direct, well,
You mustn't let any personal considerations interfere with what you have to tell me.
Why? What do you mean?
I should think you'd know better than I do. However, I'll enlarge upon my statement. For the moment, you may consider me as just someone you brought in for questioning, not the woman you're supposed to be in love with.
All right. Haskell Beecher was murdered last night.
Oh, weep for Haskell Beecher. He is dead.
You've got to help me.
Oh, I'd like to, Dan. I'd like to.
Will you?
That depends.
You never liked Haskell Beecher.
I hated him. So did you. So did every decent person who knew what he was.
True. Perhaps if I were the kind of person I used to be, if I hadn't won over my early environment... Maybe I'd have killed him myself.
Daniel.
I'm not accusing you, Lola.
I'm glad.
I'm just asking you. Did you kill him?
Simply because I hated him?
You had a motive. You drove your father to suicide.
You won out over your environment, Daniel. I remain true to mine.
I want to know. Did you kill Haskell Beecher?
Certainly not.
All right. So much for that. Although I think I knew it.
Well, that's kind of you, Daniel.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, Lola. Take down your guard. I need your help. We think we know who killed Beecher.
Oh?
We've made an arrest. We're holding the suspect.
Justice marches on.
Cut it out, Lola.
Well, what do you expect? Whatever you say, you still suspect me?
No, Lola. My word of honor.
You do. I know you. Iron-bound Morgan, this self-made man. You'd send your own grandmother to the chair if you thought she was guilty. Well, I'm not your grandmother.
Lola, I only want to ask you one question. After that, we'll pack out of here and have dinner and forget the whole business as far as you're concerned.
What do you want to know?
You didn't kill Haskell Beecher. But we think you know who did. Who was it?
How would I know?
We have positive evidence that you were at the scene of the crime no more than a minute, possibly only moments after it was committed.
It's not true.
Lola, you can't beat me on that. It is true. You know it and I know it. We have witnesses who definitely place you near the scene at the right time.
Then ask them who the killer was.
Unluckily, they were once removed from actually seeing who he was. That happens, of course. You were seen and recognized in a position where you would surely have seen the murderer leaving Haskell's apartment. We've got to know who it was.
You're talking nonsense, Daniel.
We have the suspect in the next room. We can possibly convict him without your testimony. Probably we can't. More likely that a killer, an enemy of the people, will escape punishment unless you help us.
I'm sorry, I can't tell you who it was.
You can't or you won't.
Oh, let me alone.
Lola, believe me, it isn't fun trying to send a man to his death. I don't like it. I hate it. But it's a job that someone has got to do, and I'm trying to do it to the best of my knowledge and conscience.
Yes. Honest Dan Morgan, without fear and without reproach, risen from the ranks. He hates to send a man to the chair, but he doesn't mind if I do.
I wonder if this is the contest.
Contest?
The Uptown Yankees versus the Gas House Gang. Remember our little conversation at the club last week?
Oh.
For the championship of the civilized world?
Or in the nice eye of nature, which breed is the best?
That's right. Maybe this is the showdown. Maybe this is it.
I'll tell you this, Daniel. If you love me, stop tormenting me like this.
Tormenting you?
It won't get you anywhere. And everything will be over between us, I warn you.
That's final, is it?
Quite final.
All right. Glad you dropped in, anyhow. Well, that is, the office will be in touch with you again. Naturally, future discussions will have to be on the usual formal basis. I'm only the lawyer, you know. We fell out of love 30 seconds ago.
Daniel.
You see, Lola, I may not be just the legal machine you think I am. Maybe I'm a man. Can be. If I thought for 1 minute I was asking more of you than I was giving myself...
But you are asking a great deal, Dan. Very much. You don't understand. You've become hard and brutalized in your work. Maybe the struggle to get where you are did something to you, to your humanity.
I don't think so, Lola.
Well, whatever it is, you'd never be able to understand why I've done as I've done, what I've been through in the last few minutes.
Torment, I think you call it.
Oh, you needn't sneer. It hasn't been easy for me.
It hasn't been easy for me either.
It's routine to you. One more conviction, one more charge through a condemned man's body. One more rung up the ladder that honest Dan Morgan has chosen as his way to power, to success.
That's
to...
enough. I won't torment you any further. Goodbye, Lola. It's been nice knowing you.
Dan, we can't break off like this.
What else is there? I couldn't go on with you. Knowing you shielded a possible murderer from justice. I guess I'm that kind of a fool.
Suppose I were to tell you why I can't tell you who the killer was.
I don't know if it would make any difference. I can't commit the people to any promise I might make about it.
All right, I'll tell you anyway. I can't tell you who the killer was because I was on the way to murder Haskell Beecher myself. There. Does that satisfy you?
Doesn't solve anything. Doesn't justify your silence.
Daniel, have you lost every shred of human understanding in this miserable office?
I haven't let sentiment and my personal feelings smother my sense of duty, if that's what you mean.
I was going to kill Beecher myself. The fact that someone anticipated me, that someone else got there first, doesn't excuse me. Your courts have a rule that the accuser must come to the bar of justice with clean hands himself. My hands aren't clean. I can't condemn a man for the crime I myself planned on doing. Can't you understand that? Or is that all too subtle for you?
The gas house set was short on money and position, Lola. Not on heart and human understanding and a strong moral sense. I'm sorry, but I can't follow your own queerly twisted reasoning on this matter. And I can't stay with my job under the circumstances. You've put me in a position where I'll have to quit.
Quit? Give up your post here after all your work?
I haven't much choice. Maybe that's a decision too subtle for you. I don't know.
Quit? Give up your career? Where is the suspect?
In the next room.
Show him to me.
You'll identify him?
Show him to me.
All right, I'll have to call in. Excuse me. Bradley, I'm going to open the panel here. Someone to identify the prisoner, yeah. Throw the lights on him, right. We observe suspects through the panel while they're dazzled by light. It's for your own protection, of course. Here. Now, can you see him clearly enough?
Yes.
Is that the man you saw escaping from the scene of the crime last night? Be awfully sure, Lola. Is he the man? Sure?
I'm positive.
Thanks. That'll be all, Bradley. Thanks. I'm very grateful to you, Lola. Very. And relieved.
You're relieved. You are. What about me?
Lola, I know very well how you must have felt and thought while I was driving you.
Why should you?
Why shouldn't I? He's one of my kind. That man in there started where I did, in the gas house set. He tried, but he didn't make the grade. One of the many deadly enemies Haskell Beecher succeeded in acquiring in his busy lifetime.
You seem to know all about him. Friend of yours?
In a way. He's my brother.
Your brother?
You see, I had to know, Lola.
But suppose...
I had to know, win or lose.
I see. I remember. Principle. Discipline. It's been the contest, hasn't it, Daniel?
How do I stack up in the pitch? In the nice eye of nature, how am I doing?
Wonderful, Daniel. Splendidly.
George Lovejoy Rockwell shares with Julius Leonard and Arthur Marx the distinction of never hearing his first name in public. You who heard him on Fred Allen's program last week will know that I refer to Dr. Rockwell. For many years, the doctor has been discoursing on the subject of human health in vaudeville and on the air. Despite his self-conferred degree, Philco hesitates to recommend him as a family physician. On the other hand, if your malady is simple clausoporia, a Greek disease meaning lack of laughter, the man to handle your case is undoubtedly the one who at this moment is mounting the front steps of the Radio Hall of Fame, Dr. Rockwell.
Ladies and gentlemen, here we are tonight, you and I in this great big auditorium. You've been sitting out here laughing, smiling, having a good time. But let's pause for a few seconds and ask ourselves one or two worthwhile, serious questions. Where were we 100 years ago? Where are we going to be 100 years from now? For centuries, scientists have been trying to figure out where we came from. And for centuries, the ministers have been trying to figure out where we're going. And in between, we have a third group, the Treasury Department, who say we don't care where you came from or where you're going. You're here now. How much have you got and how fast can we get it? Now, I'm not interested in talking money tonight, but I am interested in post-war. We face all kinds of radical changes, revolutionary changes in the post-war period. And at this time, I'd like to discuss with you one of our outstanding problems. Can woman ever replace the horse? Now, first of all, let us trace the evolution of mankind dating away back from the Neolithic water period up until that of today, the plutocratic age. We notice a great many changes have taken place. We see the old-fashioned hot water bottle has given way to the electric heating pad. The old-fashioned sulfur and molasses has given way to the yeast cake. And the old-fashioned bathing suit has given away entirely. Now, that's what we call change. Life is a series of changes. Everything changes. For example, look at the hair on the heads of these wonderful saxophone players. Then look at the back of my head there. And if that doesn't convince you, look at Deems Taylor's head over here. You see what I mean? It's one change after another. For instance, it's only a few weeks ago, or a few years rather, that scientists came along and gave us a wonderful invention to provide entertainment for the ear. They called it the radio. Today, they've added entertainment for the eye, and we have television. In the post-war period, they'll add entertainment for the nose, and we'll have smell-o-vision. Now, just realize, you can sit right back in your own home and inhale the perfume of a great big field of nodding daffodils, or you can look in at one man's family at breakfast and inhale the fragrant aroma of steaming coffee or sizzling bacon. Of course, if you want to, you can tune on Macy's household department in the basement and get a whiff of those camphor balls and moth flakes. But another great post-war development, electronics, will be a small pocket-sized lie detector. Every married man will have one of these lie detectors and be able to check up on his wife, if you know what I mean. That is, when she says, honey, this is not oleomargarine, he just straps a lie detector right around her wrist, and right away he knows whether she's telling the truth. Of course, if he does find out she's lying, what good will it do him? After all, he took her for butter or worse. But the place where the lie detector will be of the most value will be in the post office when you go in to try and cash a money order. When the man says to you, is this your name? You say yes. That's all there is to it. And it does away with all this red tape and trying to identify yourself. Why, yesterday, down at the main post office here, I went and tried to cash a little $10 money order. I had to pull everything out of my pockets. I showed him bills, envelopes, laundry lists, pawn tickets, supinis. He wouldn't believe me. And I finally had to pull off my coat, vest, peel off my shirt, and show him the laundry mark on the inside of my collarband. There were 15 other people there trying to cash money orders, all peeled off the same way. A stranger coming into the place couldn't tell whether it was a post office or an induction center. So you can see how valuable the lie detector is going to be. Now, another great change we face in the post-war world will be in the matter of education. We have already demonstrated that a four-year college course, can be completed in 4 years. Now, this streamlining of education will be perfected in the post-war period, and high school will only take 2 years, and grammar school 5 or 6 weeks. Now, realize what that means. The average boy is going to graduate from college when he's 9 years old. Of course, then he's got to hang around for 9 years before he can take a job without breaking the child labor laws. And by that time, he'll probably have forgotten everything he learned in college and wouldn't be able to get a job. But of course, that wouldn't make a great deal of difference, because after all, we once had a 6-day week, then we had a 5-day week. In the post-war world, we'll have a no-day week, and you wouldn't be able to tell who's working and who's a bum. Now, aside from all these wonderful changes, that goes to show that we have got to be ready to adjust ourselves to the post-war changes. In other words, how are we going to do it? Because the mind, the human mind, is a very peculiar piece of mechanism. That is, we are two different, distinct personalities. We have dual personalities, and that's due to the fact that the brain is divided into two parts, A and B. That's what causes all our trouble. For instance, A has you write a letter, and then B forgets to mail it. Now, another sample of that was the case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You remember daytimes, Hyde was a policeman, and nights, he was a burglar. The chances are none of us would have ever known anything about it if daylight savings hadn't got him all mixed up and he arrested himself. Well, there's the personality, and right out in this audience tonight, many of you folks have this dual personality. That is, you think for two persons. Of course, there are others of you who have a different type of a dual personality. You eat enough for two persons. Don't laugh. I see any number of them sitting right around here with double chins, triple stomachs, and no laps at all. Why, there's one lady sitting over there. Don't slink down in the seat, lady. Don't do that. There's no disgrace to be fat, because right at this time with a fat drive on, it's valuable. You know, fat makes glycerin, and glycerin makes gunpowder. The only trouble is if all you fat people try to crunch down and hide, we're liable to have a case here of spontaneous combustion. Now, pay attention. I may ask questions here later on, you know. The main...
Pardon me, Doc.
Oh, yes, Paul. What is it? Have you got a post-war question?
No, I'm taking up a collection.
Collection? As I was saying, ladies and gentlemen, in the post-war...
This will only take a minute.
A minute. Well, what is it, Paul?
Will you give $20 to bury a member of our local ration board?
To bury a member of your local ration board? $20? Paul? Here's $100. Bury 5 of them. Now, ladies and gentlemen, getting back to our post-war problems, the biggest change we're going to see in the field of medicine will be in the sulfur drugs. These sulfur drugs are coming out now faster than we can make up new names for them. In fact, last week, a new drug came out called sulfur bihex. Oh, my goshily. Now, the scientists claim that that's going to cure housemaid's knee. How can they prove it? These days, where can you find a housemaid? Now, there's another sulfur drug already on the market, a sulfur chewing gum. In this form, the sulfur is almost as powerful as radium. And a great deal, hundreds of our teenage boys and girls here in New York are chewing it now, and it cures sore throat. Of course, like other sulfur drugs, occasionally there are bad after effects. For instance, lots of these boys and girls go into the Paramount Theater chewing this gum, sit down, stick the sulfur gum under the seat, and out comes Benny Goodman or some other band and starts to play. Now, the kids understand, a perfect little ladies and gentlemen, they want to sit still, but all those sulfur rays are coming up through the seats. They stand it so long till finally they can stand it no longer, jump out in the aisle, and start dancing. There you are, jitterbugs. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I've outlined the main things of our post-war world, and if you leave the theater tonight, just keep this one thought in mind. Science is learning more and more about less and less, till finally we'll know everything about nothing. Thank you.
For 30 years, Jerome Kern has been turning out scores for musical comedies and more recently for motion pictures that have established him as one of the most brilliantly talented composers of this era. And so today is a gesture of gratitude to a distinguished artist, Paul Whiteman, the Radio Hall of Fame Orchestra and Chorus, Benny Goodman and Connie Boswell, joined forces to bring you a medley arranged by Theodore Weingand of some of the best-known airs of Jerome Kern.
dream is here beside me. Long the skies were overcast, but now the clouds have passed. You're dream I
With us next week, same time, same station, when the Philco Radio Hall of Fame returns with another show of shows. We'll expect you this time next week at the gate of the Radio Hall of Fame, signed Deems Taylor.
Next week, another brilliant gathering of stars with Jeanette MacDonald, Frank Morgan, the Milhurst Trio, as well as Paul Whiteman, his orchestra and chorus, and others. This is Gilbert Martin saying goodbye for Philco dealers and distributors throughout the United States and Canada. And from Philco Corporation, makers today of radio and electronic materials to help win the war. Makers tomorrow of materials for good living in a world at peace. The production staff of the Radio Hall of Fame includes Dee Engelbach, producer-director, and Abel Green, editor of Variety. The Blue Network.
The Radio Hall of Fame on Tuned to Yesterday from May 7th, 1944 from the NBC Blue Network. And that brings to a close this hour of Variety on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVillier. It's been a pleasure.